So on Facebook the other day, I read a story of a young friend that saddened me. He had food poisoning and was sick all day at school. Then on the bus, he threw up. The sad part wasn't that he was sick, but that out of 50 or so people on the bus, only one person offered to help. It's not often in a big city that people offer to help one another, especially strangers when we meet on the way. We're on the go to get somewhere, to be where we're expected. We work hard to earn money, to buy things that give us entertainment and convenience. So who has time to help a stranger? So I'm often quite surprised when strangers help. When my car broke down, the owner of the house that I was stuck in front of came out with a battery charger. Not only did he charge my battery, he also pumped two tires that looked flat. He went above and beyond. Yet my landlady recalls a time when people offered to help one another freely and willingly. People spoke to one another on the street and on the bus. Maybe I'm romanticizing in my head a time when courtesy and charity was common. Now all we see are the tops of people's heads because they're busy texting or playing on their iPhone. We rarely greet each other, let alone make eye contact. I know that often if you ask for help, people are generally willing to. But in busy places, not many people would actually offer help because they don't even take the time to see where help is needed. So, I know this is kind of early, but I thought if we could just take a time and share with your neighbor a time where you have helped a stranger, or perhaps a stranger helped you. And maybe think about, was it offered, or did you ask for help? So if you just turn to your neighbor or get them to, you know, about two or three people and just share a story. A couple, if you can talk to other people, that would be good. just share a story of when a stranger has helped you or you helped a stranger. Since I've moved to Vancouver, I've been learning how to take risks. Because when you're in a new environment, you're forced to be different. Not be different, but you're learning and you're just more aware of how different things are. And one of those things is living in community. For those of you who don't know, I live in a house of five women of all different generations, of different cultural backgrounds. That was a risk. And I didn't really know them, too, when I first started living there. And another thing that I've been learning to do is talking to people I don't know. Because if I don't have any friends here, well, how am I supposed to have any friends if I don't talk to anybody I don't? So it really forced me to be open to do new possibilities. And it also forced me to think about and reflect why I respond to certain situations the way I do. And really, it goes back to how I was raised. I was brought up with certain values, and I don't know if these are particularly Chinese values or Western values, but they were subtle lessons that I just picked up growing up that absorbed from my family. For example, one of those is you don't trust strangers. Because the fear is that you might be taken advantage of. Another lesson I picked up was to don't be in debt to anybody, meaning don't ever feel like you have to owe anybody anything. And so a way to kind of combat that is that, you know, if somebody does something nice for you, then you have to do something nice in return, right? And a common example is when you're invited to somebody's house, do you come empty-handed? Right? Never. My family, it was oranges. My mom always bring oranges or fish. Because our family caught a lot of fish. So it was a common gift. And you never, never arrive empty-handed. Another example would be, a family invites you out for dinner. And at the end of the meal, what happens? But the fight for the bill. Right? Even though you've been invited, you still have to go for, you have to fight for the bill. Especially if they had paid before, then it's your turn to pay. So it's this whole kind of don't owe anybody anything, and always pay back. You always pay back. Not that it's a bad thing, but it's just a sense of owing. And then on top of all this, Canadians, general Canadian society, we really value privacy. We don't impose ourselves on other people. So a way of showing respect to one another is actually to respect people's privacy and their distance. And we certainly don't impose our beliefs and values on somebody else. So with all this, basically I learned to keep my distance. Well, on one hand, this has taught me not to feel entitled or to take anything for granted. It has also made me more isolated. Living this way means that I depended on myself. I enjoyed my independence and self-sufficiency. It's not that I believe I did it all on my own. I regularly thank God for all the resources that I have been given. But I didn't have to need other people. And when you don't need other people, your world becomes smaller. So small that it fits just you. But I didn't realize how full of self I was until I began living with other people. And when I experienced the generosity of others, I saw how my housemates gave to the homeless or kept their eye out for those who were excluded from society. I experienced grace in the form of somebody giving to me or serving me without me ever being able to repay. The experience of altruism or grace taught me to give, and it taught me to receive. It began to change who I was. Altruism is a traditional virtue in many cultures. Altruism is the practice of concern for the welfare of others by setting aside your own self. It is the principle of thinking about others and their well-being. It is the opposite of selfishness. There are theories about altruism. Some believe that people are more likely to help another when there are more similarities, like family or kinship, or common experiences or similar passions. We also tend to help people more if they seem trustworthy. And sometimes we tend to feel that those who are more similar to us are more trustworthy. What do we trust them for? Well, to not return good with ill. We trust them that they're capable of receiving the help that we offer. And sometimes, if we're honest, that they will reciprocate the gesture to ourselves or to another. Some say the truest form of altruism is the sacrifice of oneself for someone other than the self, with no expectation of benefit, whether direct or indirect. that even when helping the other, we do not hold any expectations of return, not even the expectation of change. If that's the case, then there is no need to trust that person to repay. It doesn't matter if the person is capable of repaying or reciprocating the gesture. It won't even matter if the person causes harm in return. But does this kind of altruism exist? And if so, why don't we see more of it? Jesus exemplified the purest form of altruism, which is why even non-Christians would agree that Jesus was a good man, an innocent man. He did good for others, even to the cost of his own life. What he did was of no benefit to himself. He didn't have to, but he wanted to, because it came from who he was. It was in his very nature to be humble, generous, and selfless. And he wanted to prepare his followers to do the same. Which is why he took the time to address his disciples. The ninth chapter of Mark has been intense, starting the transfiguration, the vision of what will be, to the raising of a dead boy, despite the doubts of the disciples. Now Jesus and his disciples were walking through Galilee, and they returned to Capernaum, the place where Mark had chosen to start to mark the start of Jesus' ministry. And as they walked through Galilee, Jesus spoke of his impending death and resurrection. It wasn't the first time Jesus talked about this, yet the disciples didn't understand, and they were too scared to ask. I think that their hopes for a Messiah to overthrow the Romans was so great that it kept them from seeing what Jesus was trying to do. Their fear wasn't so much that Jesus was going to die, especially when he said he was going to come back, but their hopes for freedom wasn't going to be materialized. They were too scared to ask Jesus what he meant. Instead, we learn, they start arguing among themselves. To our surprise, they were arguing over what Jesus just told them. But who among them would be the greatest? Now, this seems kind of morbid, considering that their leader had just told them that he was going to die. And so the next discussion is like, well, who among us is the greatest? Like, are they talking about who's going to take over? Or maybe this was prompted by the failure of the disciples to heal the boy. I don't know if they were blaming each other for not being able to do that. Or maybe because only three of them got to see Jesus' transfiguration. Who knows? Maybe there was jealousy among them. But they were arguing about who was the greatest. And Jesus asked them, "Oh, what are you arguing about?" They were silent. And their silence implies their embarrassment. Or they were angry with one another. So, sitting down, Jesus begins to teach them again what it means to be a disciple. Whoever wants to be first must become last, the servant of all. This sounds completely illogical, even to a child. A friend of mine told me that when growing up in the church, this saying made no sense to her until she watched a line of kids going into a school assembly, and they sit down, and after the assembly, they all got up and just filed out the way they came in, so the last student became the first to leave. Is that what Jesus meant? Or is it about how the lowest of low can rise to the top due to perseverance, luck, or fate? Kind of like Slumdog Millionaire. The lowest of low finally making it big. Is that what Jesus meant? Well, what did first or greatest mean to these disciples? And what does being first or greatest mean to us? We can guess or summarize that these disciples were talking about power and rank. To be first in that society means to be men who can have the most influence. The religious elite, the Roman rulers, the aristocrats. So to be last and to be a servant is to have no rank, no authority, no privilege. This is hard to imagine 2,000 years later, after the establishment of the church, and with all its titles and privileges. But at that time, Jesus was telling his disciples that in order to be the greatest, they must become nobodies. Their movement was a movement towards the bottom, to receiving denial, rejection, even violence and hate. Then in a surprise move, Jesus takes a child and sets him before them. Why did Jesus take a child? A child in Greco-Roman society had no rank, no power, no value. He could say they were the most vulnerable in society. The Aramaic word for child is the same for servant. So Jesus sets the child before them as an example of discipleship. To become a child doesn't mean to become helpless and innocent, but to become a child means there's no pretense for greatness. You have nothing. You become a nobody. Have you ever wished that you could be better at something? Have you ever wished that you could be really good at one particular thing? What if you felt like you suddenly discovered that one thing that gave you importance, a feeling of belonging to something greater, a feeling like you're doing something good in the world? Then God tells you that in order for you to be great in this means that you will never be recognized for how great you are in this lifetime. In fact, in order to be great in this one thing may mean that you would be lessened in the eyes of others. Question is, would you still do it? Jesus affirms the status of the not-haves. For those who receive the little ones in his name receive not only Jesus, but the one who sent him, God the Father. To receive is essentially the same as to welcome, to treat as friend or even as family. The challenge and invitation to the disciples was to regard the least powerful in society as though they were royalty. As servants, the disciples have the greatest dignity of receiving Jesus and the one who sent him. In the same manner, whoever receives the disciples receive Jesus because Christ is the one who sent them. What Jesus was doing was reordering human relationships. This produces an equalizing effect. Instead of a society of hierarchy and rank, Jesus was establishing a kingdom of children, sisters and brothers, serving each other as friends. The rest of the lesson goes into a discussion about those who don't belong to the group and yet act with the same authority. It's a bit ironic because the disciples could not drive out the evil spirit in the previous passage, yet here was an outsider who could perform this healing. Jesus tells them to leave the exorcist alone, for he was doing the work of the kingdom in bringing healing and restoration in Jesus' name. The exorcist recognized Jesus' authority and was working against the forces of evil. Hence, they were on the same team, so to speak. There's a lesson here for the disciples against exclusivism. They don't have to be territorial when the kingdom is big enough for all. Participation in the kingdom of God is greater than we might think. An act of kindness, such as giving a cold drink in the desert heat, is an act of great hospitality. It becomes particularly significant when the hospitality is offered to someone because they are followers of Jesus Christ. God blesses those who bless his followers. Which makes me wonder that as I receive from others, the greater blessing is on those who give. Even though they may not be Christian yet, because they bless me for following Jesus, their reward will not be taken from them. However, whoever causes these little ones who believe in Jesus to stumble, these little ones reference back to the people like the exorcist who work in the name of Jesus. So whoever causes them to stumble in their faith will face dire consequences, such that it would be better for them if they were drowned in the sea. Doing good for others also means not causing harm to them. It also means not causing harm to oneself. The rest of the passage has more warnings against sin and being enslaved to sin. The disciples still need to take responsibility for their actions. So then, whoever wishes to be first, whoever desires to be a leader, must become last. To become last is to be a servant of all. And to be a servant means you become the lowest in terms of power and influence. And to be servant of all also means taking responsibility for one's actions. So why? Why would I want to be the last? What if I don't want to be the greatest? I believe that his answer to us is still the same, which is, this is who I am. I am a God who loves you, who came to love you by giving away my own life. I am a God who sees the lowest of the low and embraces them. I am a God who calls the greatest to account for the power they hold. I am a God who does not abandon you, but shows you the way to life. And if you're still looking at the Christian life and wondering what benefit is that to me, that question is as wrong as the question of who is the greatest. The question that we should be asking is, how does my following Christ help to serve others? How does my Christian life benefit the world? This is also why we cannot live in isolation. Christ calls us to live in service to one another, to bless each other by helping each other to receive Christ. I do believe that if we call ourselves Christians, then we welcome people, particularly those who are different from us. Not only do we extend the welcome of Christ, but we receive the welcome of Christ. When we welcome the stranger, it means we're creating space so that he or she are no longer stranger, but friend. I want to take a moment in our reflection to think about, have you made any new friends lately? And this might be a time for you to think about the friends in your life, how they've blessed you and how you've blessed them. And to even consider, are we friends with one another in our congregation? And I also got little note cards that I'm going to pass around. And I want to take a time, this is an exercise. I believe, a Christian spiritual practice of writing a thank you note to somebody in your life. Just to say how much you appreciate them, or maybe there's something they've done. I believe that there's not a lot of thank yous that go around in our society. It's very cutthroat. So I feel that if we could extend the welcome of Christ by simply just showing gratitude and thankfulness, that's a good way to fight against the spirit of competition and the spirit of survival of the fittest in our workplaces and in our communities. So there are a few pencils here. I don't know who needs a pen. I do have a few pens. So I'm going to pass out these note cards and take as many as you feel you would need. Just take a moment to write a thank you note.